Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Welcome to a new episode of the EAN podcast. Sitting in the studio this time is Jana Middelfart-Hoff, professor and a specialist in neurology, and I am joined by a dear colleague,
Marta Roa Syvertsen, consultant in neurology and head of science and research, also from Norway.
This is a podcast episode that we hope can be both for the professional neurologist, but also for the parent, the grandparents, the teacher, or anybody who has to do with teenagers. What is actually happening when the sensible 10-year-old becomes a volcano of feelings at 13? Why are teenagers both so brave and risk-seeking and then so crushed by the wrong word? Marta here is an expert on the juvenile brain, and together we will try to make sense of it for you. But first, Marta, tell the listeners, who are you?
So I'm a medical doctor. I've been working with and studying epilepsy since medical school, actually. And I run a multidisciplinary national network of epilepsy experts. And I'm also very keen on communicating science to the general public, because I think that's an important task for us when we study things in depth, especially nowadays with the growth of social media and all kinds of experts all over the place.
So, yeah. That's true, because you're a real expert and not a TikTok expert. That is very important. Because when did you actually start to be interested in what happens in the brains of teenagers, and why this interest?
Well, that started as part of my PhD project, actually, when I was working with juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, which is a type of epilepsy with onset during teenage years. So during those studies, I became very fascinated with brain maturation, and particularly in the teenage brain, because there's really so much going on there from a neurobiological point of view. And also as a consequence of that, from a point of view of real life, actually, because all of these things, understanding them and gaining insight into these mechanisms, it kind of helps to understand human beings and human behavior in general, actually. So that has been very giving, I think, to work with.
So teenagers were sort of an opener to the whole brain for you, could you say that?
Not really. I think to me, it was actually literature that opened the brain field, and some famous writers with epilepsy, for instance. But that led me into brain maturation, yes. And also with all the new technology that we've gained access to during the last 10 years that has really opened this field. Very interesting.
Because you are not only a very successful neurologist doing a lot of complicated research and having received a lot of awards for your science, but you have also written a fantastic book too, not only for neurologists and health personnel, but for all of us, The Juvenile Brain, which is definitely to be recommended. It's, however, only in Norwegian at the moment, so if there are any publishers out there, do get that book translated, I have to say. But what is your experience with teenagers at the present? Do you have anybody around?
Well, I think we all do all the time, and we've been teenagers ourselves as well, obviously. So a lot of things can be applied to our own personal lives, I think. And when I started writing that book, working on it, I had two girls, little girls, still children, but now one of them is already a 12-year-old, and she is heading full speed into everything that I've been writing about and trying to teach others. And you know, it's always harder in your own life than in theoretical life. So now I'm trying to apply the advice that I give to others. And it's difficult.
It's very difficult. It's difficult even for those who read your book. I read it, and when my 20-year-old boys were in their teenager year, and I also found it very useful, but also difficult, because there is something particular about the juvenile brain. What is actually happening, and why has somebody described the juvenile brain as a site of construction, which I actually think is very proper.
Yeah, it's very proper. And there are lots of things going on, considering emotions, considering sleep, considering learning, etc., and motivation, not the least. But I think the most important part is the brain maturation process by itself, meaning the process of making the networks and the connections of the brain more efficient. And that is a process that starts already at birth, or even before birth, actually. It's a continuous construction and building of neuronal networks. Making synapses is one thing that goes on full speed in the baby brain. But then entering the teenage years, and also children, they need more efficient networks for the electricity and the signals to pass as fast as possible. And that's a process starting at the back of the brain in the occipital lobes in very young children or from the very beginning. And then it moves gradually, step by step, towards the front of the brain. And that is a process that takes quite a long time. We say that we're not really there until about 20, 25 years of age. So that leaves us, you know, with the prefrontal cortex as the final site of construction in the teenage brain.
The parent of the brain, like I used to say. And I have to say, we've discussed this before, Marta, and I definitely would say 25. I have two fine student sons, and they are the best, but I definitely would say 25, because there are still some things to be had in the frontal cortex, the parent of the brain. Because what kind of consequences do this maturation process have, this construction and the actually imbalance that occurs in the brain in these important years, for the teenagers and also for the society?
Well, you know, the consequences are quite big, actually. And that's what makes this so exciting, because it means something in real life, you know. So what we need to ask ourselves is, what exactly does the prefrontal cortex do that we can expect to be less efficient in a still developing brain? And the common term of the functions of the prefrontal cortex is executive functions, which I struggled a little bit with during my PhD, because I thought it was a little bit hard to define it, actually. But let's think about it as the leader, the chief executive officer, the CEO of the brain and of you.
I like that very much.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's where we make all our conscious decisions, and we put them into a broader perspective, thinking about long-term consequences of our choices and the kind of behavior that we select and plan for in that particular moment. So it's basically, to simplify it even more, that's where your motor actions start from, because all behavior involves motor action or movement. So that the planning of a motor action starts at the very pole of the prefrontal cortex, and then the signal travels to the back towards the motor areas, and then to the spinal cord and the muscles, mm-hmm. etc.
And that's also something that you have written about, that there is an imbalance in the teenager brain, that they have a lot of feelings. The limbic system is very activated, but the system that should filter the feelings, and that is the reason that you and I, when we're annoyed in a queue or something, don't go up to the person in front of us and beat them or give them a brush. We manage to calm down, most of us. So some adults still don't have that function. But for the teenagers, as the feelings are so strong and they don't have anything or very little to regulate them, that is perhaps something that influences this age and also how they get along with people around them and in society, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. The prefrontal cortex and the executive function is sensible voice, you know, in telling the emotions to calm down. And the limbic system is full of receptors for sex hormones. And the surge of sex hormones following puberty or at the onset of puberty, they attach to the limbic system, for example, to the amygdala, the fear and anxiety alarm system, and fires that up. And without an efficient break then and sensible voice from the prefrontal cortex, that is a very explosive
mixture. Oh, definitely.
Combination.
Oh, yes.
It's not that it's not there, that sensible voice. It just takes a bit longer, you know, simply because the pruning of the synapses and the myelin of the axons, it's not quite ready yet. It's still under construction.
And I think that makes us also very sensitive to knowledge at that age. I mean, things that I learned as a teenager, I had my English teacher learning me a Shakespeare sonnet, which he said would be handy if I needed to find the man of my life later on. So I can still cite, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" That was not how I found my husband, but it might have been. But and the songs and all the things you remember very well, and I don't remember so much from what I studied in medicine, for instance. So the juvenile brain is vulnerable, but it's also a possibility, you have stated.
Yeah, because we learn faster when we are adolescents, because synapses simply form more quickly. You don't need as many repetitions to make it fire or excitable. You don't need as many repetitions as an adult when you're a child and a teenager. Another thing is that memory and learning things is highly attached to feelings as well. So it's much more likely for us to remember anything if we have some kind of emotion activated at the same time. Think about the hippocampus, the brain structure responsible for attaching episodic memories to the cortex of the brain. That is the closest neighbor of the amygdala. They're closest neighbors. So when the amygdala fires, if you get scared, but also other feelings, happiness, for example, the hippocampus labels that memory and thinks, oh, this was important, let's remember that. So if the amygdala is more active in the first place, then theoretically you should also get stronger memories.
Yeah, I think that's true for many of us. I am the mother of two young men. You are the mother of two young daughters. And I have to say, I think that there is a gender difference. Do you think that about boys and girls and the way that they are developing? Not that they're not developing, both of them, but not at the same time, perhaps?
Yeah, there are gender differences, and I think it's important to address them and talk about it also, because this too has practical consequences in real life school systems, for example, and the kind of expectations that that our adolescents face. One of the most important differences, perhaps, is the timing of these final steps of brain maturation, because it is closely linked to the onset of puberty, this final maturation of the executive networks. And puberty starts 1 or 2 years earlier in girls. That's just the way it is. So maybe in preteen years or early teenage years, girls will be statistically a little bit ahead of boys when it comes to executive functioning. And the other important point is that testosterone also has an effect on brain function, as the estrogen, but let's talk about testosterone for now. There are several studies pointing towards the fact that testosterone actually lowers the activity of some connections between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. And that's the connections that we just talked about, the important breaks in between emotions and the sensibility of the consequence thinker, the CEO. So some people claim that testosterone may actually inhibit executive function in a way. possibly explaining the risk-taking behavior in boys, which statistically is more common in boys, but also self-confidence, you know, because that internal voice telling you that, you know, you made a mistake, perhaps you're not good enough, is also an executive function. So there are pros and cons.
There are pros and cons, definitely. But I had a very funny experience. I gave a lecture to a psychology class where the pupils were 18 years old. And I told them about that, well, boys and girls, and I told them about the female brain maturing at more than the boys at that the boys would be behind. And the boys, of course, didn't like that. But one, he got very thoughtful, and then he said, I think this is so unfair. We 18-year-old boys are in a class with 20-year-old girls, and we are still graded the same way. And I thought that was, he grasped the concept that this is, of course, not on an individual basis, but it's on a group level. But that in these crucial years, where often so much is decided in our education systems about the possibilities that you have, the boys are behind the girls. And that might be a reason that you see that there are more boys falling out of the school system than girls, because girls have a little more frontal cortex, which enables them to understand that it's important to read for the tests and to get up in the morning. And these are these simple functions. So I think that that was very illustrative for me, I have to say. But Mart,
yeah, especially in early teenage years. I mean, when they're younger, the differences are even bigger.
That's true.
Probably.
But Marte, we are parents, but we are also neurologists. And if we should say to our colleagues, be interested in the juvenile brain, why should they? Why should neurologists care whether the brain is young or old?
Oh, we should all care about that, because this is about being human, you know, about understanding life itself, really. But we as neurologists, we treat patients. We meet teenagers or we meet teenagers or young adults in the transition from pediatric ward and department. So knowing what kind of responsibility that or and what we can expect from this patient group makes a lot of sense, for sure, to have insight and knowledge about that. And also, of course, there are also disorders particularly affecting this age group, like, for example, juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, where challenges regarding executive functions are particularly prevalent. But also understanding the function of the prefrontal cortex is very valuable alone, detached from the teenage phase as well, because it's one third of our brain, or the entire frontal lobe is. Prefrontal cortex is slightly smaller, but it's the biggest in all species that we know in humans. So for sure, we need to know what's going on there.
We need to know what's going on. And we also need, as neurologists, I think, to know what's going on in order to provide the right form for treatment. Because you say that it's true that some diseases affect juvenile more than other age classes. But it's also like that we see, for instance, with patients with epilepsy, that they start to become difficult when they are in their teenage years. They don't take the medication properly. They don't meet for blood tests. They don't show up for polyclinical appointments and so on. And sometimes I think we still need to demand something of them, but we also need to understand that the framework isn't there. When you have so much to think about, your first love and the football match and everything, whether you're liked or not, it can be very hard to remember that you have an appointment in the hospital next week at 4 o'clock on Wednesday. So I think that should be something to think about in the way how we interact with the teenagers. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, organizing appointments, remembering blood tests, and also understanding your own good in a large perspective, this is executive functions spot on what we ask of them. And they're able to do it. It just takes more effort, and sometimes other things will gain priority instead. For example, social attachment, which is probably the number one priority to all of us, but teenagers in particular, because they are in transition between their family and an independent life, which is biologically completely sensible. That's what's going to happen, needs to happen at that time of life. So they will, I think, statistically always choose friends and belonging. That's perhaps the most risky thing they can ever do, also from a biological point of view, to lose their group or be standing alone. Being diagnosed with a chronic disorder, that's not what you
That's
want.
not cool at all. That's true. Therefore, I think it's important that we don't leave them alone and that we don't automatically think that a 16-year-old should be fully capable to cope with his disease and also to meet up for treatment, to follow up and so on. And this is not just for neurology. This is for diabetes. There are many chronic diseases that are having problems in teenager years, and I think that this is one of the reasons. But we said that the juvenile brain is a site of construction, and you and I are both a little bit concerned, and we also want to give people some tools because we think that the juvenile brain should be supported so that the youngsters come out of this phase as good as possible. Could you say something about that? What can parents listening to us now, Marte, what should they do for their teenagers?
Well, I think we need to think about executive prefrontal function the way we think about other brain functions that are under construction in younger children, because we are very quick to help younger children with, for example, making a meal or helping them dress when they're smaller. So for a teenager, I think we need to keep on being there, being present. It seems obvious, but this is from a neuroscientific point of view. We need to be the assisting CEO, simply, an external assisting CEO in their lives. And also, yeah, to define boundaries, being there, being available, and also try to handle our own frustration, maybe, because we should be better equipped for that,
Theoretically,
theoretically.
we should have a frontal cortex that tells us that we do the talk when they're not so angry, sad anymore, when the smoke has evaporated, so to say. Yes, I agree completely with you. And I sometimes say to parents who ask me that, I say that they're not required to be superheroes. Nobody is, but it's very good to be there at all. To remember that teenagers, that you must work together with them to establish a frame that they do not have, because they're under construction. They are focusing on other things than be getting enough sleep, getting enough to eat, or the right things to eat, to be sure to have a balance between physical activity and rest and so on. And whereas in small children you have to guide them very clearly, in older children I think it's also important to be in the dialogue. And to they need to make their own experiences, but they don't have to experience all that is. Do you agree on that?
I completely agree that because that is the basics or the base of neuroplastic change and brain maturation is the practical use of those networks, you know. So they need to be able to go through trial and error in order to make those connections and the pruning where it's supposed to be pruned. But in a safe environment, ideally, that we as adults can provide. And by staying in dialogue, we are available and we should not be afraid to take the lead, you know, to be the CEO when needed. And because things will happen, they will fail, and they will need our assistance. We don't know when, But that's what being there means, that we are present and available when something happens.
Oh, I think that was a good said, Marte. Present and available when something happens. I think that is very good. We are coming to the end of this podcast, but I think we can agree that the teenage brain has a huge potential, but needs to be protected. We need, as parents, if we can, to be there for them. And as a society, we need to acknowledge that the juvenile brain is a special thing. And maybe we need to adjust a little bit more to the juvenile brain than it needs to adjust to us, because the range of adjustment for a brain under construction can be limited. And we have also concluded, Marta, that neurologists definitely should be interested in the juvenile brain, because it's interesting in itself what happens. The prefrontal cortex is a very intriguing place in the brain, but also because this can explain why treatment of this group sometimes turns out completely different than expected, and that maybe you should adapt another strategy when treating teenagers. Would that sum it up, you think?
I agree, Jana. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here, Marte. This was great. I learned a lot, and I hope that our listeners did too. So thank you to all listeners.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.